Can we detect who has Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease?
Is there a role for immunonutrition in people in the intensive care unit?
Physician, save thy breath.
And an update on the Ebola virus infection.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 8th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center, El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should start first with, I revealed to you already, I really love saying Creutzfeldt-Jakob, even though I really don't want to have it at any point, but let's talk about that one first. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
What you mentioned, something called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, is otherwise known as a prion disease. These are fatal neurodegenerative diseases, very difficult to diagnose. This infectious agent, or prion, is a little bit unusual. It's a misfolded protein, and it replicates in the host without the use of nucleic acids, and the person's asymptomatic. By the time the symptoms have developed, large quantities of this misfolded protein have accumulated in the brain and in the central nervous system, and it makes it look like a sponge. That's why it's called spongiform. Now, this disease is present in sheep. It's called scrappy. It's present in cows. It's called mad cow disease, or bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Well, we're animals too. And it's estimated, for example, in the United Kingdom, where one of these studies done, is there are 30,000 individuals that have infection with this prion but are asymptomatic. Question is, how can you detect it? Previously, it was done by biopsy, brain biopsy, a little too invasive for routine diagnostic purposes. And in these two studies, one that used urine samples, and the second that took nasal swabs, what's called a real-time quaking or shaking induced conversion RT assay. Boy, that's a lot of noise. To look at the nasal swabs, and they used a sonicated protein misfolding cyclic amplification, or PMC assay, in the urine to identify very small amounts of this. They were 93 to 97% sensitive and 100% specific for identifying this particular disease in people that are known to have it.
Well, that's really fascinating, but let's talk about the application of this for detection, because why is it important for us to detect this in the folks who are infected?
Its main use will be for infection controls. If we know that a person has it and they're asymptomatic, you would treat their surgeries different, you would treat their bodily fluids different, and we'd also begin to follow them to see if they transmit it to other individuals as well.
All good ideas, of course, but I suggest to you that the frequency of this is just so low that while it's got a lot of sci-fi aspects to it, like alien, there's a prion in my brain that's going to take it over, which it does, but it does take it quite a long time to get there. Does this really truncate life for most people? I think the answer to that is no. Is it really important that we detect this thing when it really doesn't seem to be something that is going to affect a large number of people?
I think these studies are interesting for two things. One is, it's a technological advancement to detect a protein in minute quantities. Secondly, for individuals that may be suspected to have it, this is a non-invasive way that may be effective for diagnosing it. I agree with you. It's not going to be a routine screening assay across the population, but for targeted individuals that have neurologic symptoms, I think it could have value.
Interesting. Well, hopefully we'll be around to see just how broadly applicable this is. Since we're talking about broadly applicable, of course, let's turn to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, the patients who've been transported here to the U.S., and this is in the New England Journal of Medicine also.
So we're going to report on two things, Elizabeth. One is the New England Journal of Medicine report of the emergence of this Ebola virus in Guinea. And then we're going to talk about the CDC report. In March of 2014, the World Health Organization was notified of an outbreak of what was thought to be a communicable disease in Guinea that was characterized by fever, severe diarrhea, vomiting, and a high fatality rate. They did virologic investigations and identified that it was the Ebola virus. They did genome sequencing and what's called phylogenetic analysis to show that these individuals that were initially infected, about 68 individuals at the time, share the common Ebola virus. It looked like it probably entered that region in December of 2013 via a two-year-old. It was thought that in some way this two-year-old had exposure to bats. That two-year-old became the sentinel case responsible for spreading of this disease throughout Guinea. So let's fast forward and let's talk about the CDC and what they've reported. There are 1,171 confirmed or suspected cases of Ebola virus. Of those 1,171 suspected cases, about 972 have died already. The fatality rate is usually reported somewhere between 75 and 90%. This is a virus that's transmitted by bodily fluids or by blood. You have to come in contact with bodily fluids. Over the course of the last several months, this has become a significant problem in sub-Saharan Africa.
And of course, now we've got a couple of patients at least who've been transported here to the U.S., and there's a lot of concern and a lot of, I'm going to call it almost panic-driven behavior over whether these people could actually be a huge source of contagion.
The Center for Disease Control has a very well-established protocol that covers the entire process from identifying the American overseas to how they get them here. So there's really very little concern that it will actually be transmitted to the U.S. What's of greater concern is people that are boarding commercial airlines from there. People have to fill out a questionnaire before they board the airplane. The incubation period of this virus is between 2 to 21 days. Average time to disease symptoms is about 8 to 10 days.
Right. So clearly somebody can be infected, maybe still have subclinical disease, but be transported on a commercial airline.
Well, according to the CDC, you can't get Ebola from a person who is infected that doesn't have symptoms. Individuals who are not symptomatic are not considered to be contagious. I want to give credit to the CDC and the related organizations that got on this very quickly.
Okay. It's going to be a developing story. No doubt we'll have more to say about it later. Let's turn then to something I served up as Physicians Save Thy Breath, and that is in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Brief interventions and trying to get folks to quit using drugs in the physician's office really are not very effective.
You know, in 2011, we had an estimated 1.25 million hospitalizations that related to drug overdoses in the United States. It is a leading cause of fatal injuries in the United States, estimated about 40,000 deaths per year. Can we appropriately intervene? One can do brief interventions in individuals that have alcohol use disorders, and they are known to be effective. Does the same hold true for people that use other drugs? So there were two studies in JAMA that address this. In one study, there were three groups, 528 individuals total, randomized to test two different brief counseling interventions. This was administered by adult primary care physicians. The second study was also a large study. It 868 adults. And they had a brief 30-minute intervention. And then they went and looked at 6 and 12 months later and said, how effective were these brief interventions? And Elizabeth, you couldn't have summed it up better. Save your breath. Because unfortunately, these brief interventions were not helpful.
It is disappointing, but I would say probably not surprising. This is clearly a very thorny issue. It's multifactorial for most people. And if we take a look at the natural history of folks who use drugs in an abusive way, it takes a number of strategies in order to get them to stop doing that.
You're right. It's not an isolated drug use issue oftentimes. What that means is we need to have some way of having easily accessible treatment services with long-term follow-up.
On that note, then, let's turn to our final study. That's on this thing, immunonutrition. Wow, there's a new term for me. And that's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
I picked this particular study because I didn't even know what it was. We know that people that are in the intensive care unit, and particularly those that are on a mechanical ventilator, need to have nutritional support. There's been some thought that if we could somehow boost the immune system, because when they're in the intensive care unit and on a ventilator, it activates the inflammatory system. Somehow speed the recovery of the patient, or more importantly, prevent infectious diseases that are common in these individuals. In 14 different intensive care units in the Netherlands, Germany, France, and Belgium, they identified 301 adult patients on a ventilator and expected to be on a ventilator for more than 72 hours. They randomized them to the routine high-protein nutritional support that everybody would get, or the high-protein nutritional support with the immunomodulating agents. Well, unfortunately, there was no significant difference in the incidence of new infections. There was a higher 6-month mortality rate in those that received the immunonutrition, 57% increase in the risk of dying at 6 months. So it's a great concept. It just doesn't reduce infection. And there's a hint that it may actually be harmful.
Wow. Yet one more of those things that a priori sounded like a good idea and then when subjected to real scrutiny turned out to not only not be good, but turns out to be bad.
And I'm going to even put it in a broader perspective. There are a number of meta-analyses that suggested this could be helpful. Now, remember, a meta-analysis is where you take a bunch of smaller studies, you try to group them together to see if there's a trend. And oftentimes, those meta-analyses suggest a trend. But when you do a large, randomized, prospective trial, the hypothesis doesn't hold up. And this is a good example of that.
Okay. On that note, then, I'll reveal that I'm going to talk about Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.